If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
You're sitting on a pile of intellectual property if you're a business owner, and you're probably not going to know what to do with it, but we can help you with sorting that out and at least telling you what pitfalls to be aware of as you navigate your way forwards.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Hey, we are joined today by Greg Butcher and Madeline Lapidus. Greg has been on the show before. I think you might remember him with Blue Sky Equity. Look back through our episodes. I'm sure you'll find that interview with Greg. This is our first episode actually co-hosting a call. And also we are joined by Madeline Lapidus. Excited to have Madeline on today. She focuses on trademark prosecution and enforcement for companies in a wide variety of industries. She has a background in bioengineering and a broad understanding of how different types of intellectual property work together to protect and promote client brands. Madeline, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Oh, this is great. This is great. We've not had somebody on that specializes in what you do. Here as, you know, obviously commercial real estate syndicators, as we're growing our businesses and brands, can you kind of just talk to us about what it looks like to protect our brand, steps we should be doing, things that you see people doing right, doing wrong? Just give us the rundown if you can.
I think the biggest thing is to always Google before you select a name. I can't tell you how many times people just skipped that number one step. Make sure that your safe search is off when you're Googling whatever name you want to do business under. You'd be surprised what is out there. And I think the biggest mistake that I see is people have limited thinking when they first start out in business. They think, I'm only going to operate in Southern California, or I'm only going to operate in Northern Florida. So somebody who's across the country using a similar name isn't a threat, doesn't affect me. But the truth is, if you're successful, you're going to grow pretty rapidly. And especially in our age, where everything is online and you're doing a lot of marketing across state lines, even if you're focusing only in one region, you are going to come into conflict with other marks across the country or potentially across the world, depending on how big your enterprise grows. Don't think too small when you're selecting a name. Don't assume that you're never going to come into conflict with somebody just because they're bigger or farther away. And from there, I think that the key is it's important to select a name that balances describing what you do. So somebody looking at the name knows immediately what area you focus in, but also selecting at least one term that is fairly recognizable in its own right, such that you would be able to protect it. And other people in the industry wouldn't be able to argue that they should be entitled to use something similar just because it is a term that is frequently used within that industry. So, you know, when you think about a classic trademark where it's like Acme Real Estate Investment Group, anybody's going to be able to use the words real estate investment group. But if you select that Acme component that is either an arbitrary term or a fanciful term that you've made up, then you should be able to protect that pretty robustly.
What does that look like in protection? Like what are some steps that we should be taking, you know, out of the gate as we select these names or as we select these terms?
So trademark rights are accrued through use. If you're operating all over the world, I should add the caveat that many countries do not function that way. They function on a first to file basis. But in the US, we function on a use basis, which means that even if you don't register your trademark federally, you accrue rights just through using the mark. So if you're a small business and you don't have the budget for federal protection, that's fine. You can still start building strong trademark rights just through the way you use the mark. For example, you can put the TM notation next to the mark in marketing copy and on your website. That anybody can use that to signal that they consider a term protectable, that they consider it a source indicator that points to them exclusively, and that they would think that anybody else using a similar mark would cause confusion in the marketplace. Those are really, you know, the core elements of what a trademark is. So even if you don't have the budget to start investing in federal protection, there are definitely concrete steps you can take. You can put the TM next to the mark. At the bottom of your website, you can include an intellectual property rights, little language that says, you know, copyright 2021, whatever your business name is, all trademarks, you know, accrue to the use of whatever your business name is. If you do have a couple hundred to $1,000 to throw at trademark rights, you should consider federal registration, which takes around 2 years, probably closer to three now, to achieve. But your priority date, which means the date from which you can start enforcing your trademark rights, dates back to the date that you actually file your application. So you are considered to have constructive nationwide trademark rights as of the date that you filed your federal application, which is huge, especially in the online arena. A federal registration, you know, it's for one class, it's around $300, assuming that there's no issues from filing to issuance of the registration. And you can take that and use it to take down copycat websites. You can use it to take down people who snap up similar domain names, but with different GTLD extensions, so like .org or .biz instead of .com. It becomes very difficult for people with similar marks to argue innocent adoption because you have constructive priority nationwide. So if you do ever have to litigate and you become big enough that that's an issue, you get much greater monetary damages at the end of that you stand to collect. So yeah, first step, protect it, you know, search for it, make sure it looks clear. I would definitely recommend engaging an attorney to do that if you can afford one, but if not, at least Google with Safe Search Off and start using the proper notation to signal to consumers and competitors that you view it as an enforceable, protectable mark right out the gate using the TM notation. And then if budget permits, explore a federal registration to get that nationwide priority.
Right. So if I hear this right, once we get the filing for the federal registration, then we can immediately begin using just the fact that we filed, and maybe not even necessarily that we've gotten it, you know, the federal registration complete. We can just say, hey, look, we filed for this, you know, stop using our brand. Is that right?
Yeah, it becomes a lot easier to enforce against entities and individuals, platforms such as, you know, facilitating platforms like e-commerce platforms and payment platforms like PayPal and Stripe and domain hosts and all of that. They're really not going to respond to you until you have a registration. But individuals and entities who are infringing, they definitely wake up and pay attention when you filed an application, much more so than when you're merely using the mark with the TM notation on your website, because it tells them that this is something that you've actually taken affirmative steps to invest in and you're willing to put money behind your defense of it.
Wow. Wow. Greg, you got anything?
Yeah, you know, I always wondered too, you know, I have my website built about a year ago or so, and I see the copyright note down there, and I see that on several of people's websites also. And I always wondered, okay, is this even real without having filed for it in the first place? So it sounds like the answer is yes, but you'd get much more protection based off actually filing. Is that fair to say, Madeline?
So I should clarify, there's a difference between trademarks and copyrights, and they are frequently conflated. But legally, there's a pretty distinct difference. So trademark rights accrue through use. You get some very substantial benefits from federal registration, but they accrue through use. Copyright also, similarly, you get a copyright in your work as soon as you create the work and publish it. So you do not need to federally register your copyright. You own that material wherever it appears. If it is a work with enough of an artistic element, which just means it can be an article that you wrote or something you drew or a web page layout that you created, it's protectable straight out the gate. You don't need to do really anything else with copyrighted material to be able to enforce that effectively. And platforms will absolutely respond to copyright takedown requests based on infringing language or images or anything like that. Trademarks, though, it becomes tricky when somebody's not actually copying your photos or your text or your website layout, but they have a similar trade name, such that people are beginning to come to you and ask, are you affiliated with these guys? Because they're doing something that's kind of tangential to what you're doing. That becomes much easier to police if you have the federal trademark registration. But even if you don't, if you have filed an application, it signals to whoever's on the other side of that demand letter that you are willing to protect your mark. That is separate from copyright, because the penalties for copyright infringement are so draconian and so far-reaching that you're going to get a much faster response generally if you are, if it's domestic copyright infringement from anybody, from the infringer, from the host, from the facilitating platforms. So if you're running up against a case of infringement where they're copying not just your name or not even your name, but all of your marketing collateral and that kind of thing, you're much more likely to see quick results by pursuing it on a copyright front just because it's such a serious allegation.
That's interesting. I was going to ask that, like in the real estate space, what are you seeing occur that makes us need to take these steps? Like what are some things that are happening that are bad for us as investors?
When a lot of people get started, they, like I mentioned at the beginning, they don't think about competitors that are far away from them, either in terms of the services that are rendered or geographically, which means that several years down the line, there is, after both parties grow and expand either their services or their geographic location, there is conflict that manifests that could have been avoided if that had been considered from the outset. The other thing is, people, when they first start up online, they want to populate their websites with content, and we're seeing more and more people outsource that job. You need to be really careful with that because you are going to be on the hook for the content that's on your website. But a lot of these companies are not even located in the United States, and they don't have an appreciation for the seriousness of United States copyright law. And so they'll scrape from other websites and pull in content from other websites to populate your website with what looks like legitimate content, but which is in reality pulled from around the web. So if you are outsourcing your content generation to another company, I would recommend just doing sporadic checks where you copy and paste a paragraph or a couple of lines from your website just into Google and see if it matches anything else on the web. You know, that's obviously a very rough way to get a handle on what's going on. And ideally, you would have some rock solid agreements in place. You know, if you become a big company and you're able to outsource these things, you're going to have non-competes and non-disclosures and waivers and all of that. But at this point, I think, you know, it's important to at least do some self-checks on that. Because like I said, if you're outsourcing to someone outside the United States, they're not going to care so much about the potential for copyright damages domestically, but you are going to be on the hook for the content on your website. And you're looking, if they took images from another website and those images are registered with the Copyright Office, you're looking at triple damages, potentially, you know, like tens of thousands of dollars for the use of one image. So it's super important when it comes to stock images, you know, make sure that whatever agency or individual you've outsourced to has the rights to use those stock images and that they are commercial rights, because a lot of times people will buy stock images and the contract says that they can be used non-commercially, you know, and if they appear on a commercial website, that's a problem. You've violated the contract and you don't have any real copyright defense there. So just, you know, crossing your T's and dotting your I's. And obviously, if you can afford an attorney, this is what we do. This is, you know, we this is all in the back of our heads. But there are things that you can do as an individual to just kind of monitor your intellectual property and make sure you're taking the right steps.
Yeah, I mean, because it's a double-edged sword. One, you've got to protect it from other people taking it, and then you've also got to watch your own back from accidental misuse.
Yeah.
I mean, just like you were saying, the checking for the commercial rights to things, I've learned something new here. So, you know, one, I appreciate your time. I would have assumed that if you get on something like, you know, stock photo, whatever it is, you know, you sign up, you pay for the subscription, I don't know, whatever it is. I think there's a sound library. I'm thinking there's a thing that I paid for a year because I needed some sound actually for this podcast. So I think I paid $100 or whatever it is for an annual membership, but I have no idea. I've got to go back and actually look at that and go, hey, wait, is there commercial rights attached to that? Because I would have just assumed that if you paid for it and they're selling the sounds that you can use it, but I'm hearing that's not the case.
You should really read all of those contracts. I know that they seem dense and like something that you can just click the box and sign, but they do kind of shift it with fonts, for example. There's all of these font libraries online where you can get cool fonts. However, a lot of them have contracts where the pricing is based on, is it non-commercial or commercial? Okay, if it's commercial, what tier of commercial is it? Is it going to be on up to 10,000 packages or marketing copy, or is it going to be above 10,000, you know, packages or marketing copy, because there's different tiers. And if you pay for one tier, but you're using it on another, you're going to run into problems there. And there are whole cottage industries that have sprung up around that enforcement. I'm sure some of your listeners have probably received threatening letters from Getty Images, because they are a huge player in this industry. They own just an amazing amount of stock imagery online that is, you know, when you Google it, it's the first, when you Google a word, it'll be like the one of the first images that comes up. And so people will frequently, you know, copy paste onto their own website. Getty and other, you know, similar companies, they own the copyrights in those, and they have teams of attorneys and automated processes that crawl the web looking for people who have done exactly that, so that they can send a letter and say, listen, it doesn't matter that you were using this on your personal cooking blog where you published recipes for your family to read. You owe us at least $10,000 because you used, you know, this one image on this one page. So you do, it's you can get slapped really, really hard in the copyright space. Trademark is a little bit more, I don't want to say lenient, but there's a little bit more nuance there, just because the test for trademark is likelihood of confusion. So unless you're using an identical brand name on identical services, you usually can argue that, you know, because of how you're portraying it or because of secondary indicia on your website, the public's not going to be confused about this use, and so it's not infringing. When it comes to copyright infringement, it doesn't matter who's confused about what. If you use somebody else's copyrighted material, you're on the hook for it.
Wow, that's amazing. So what about sites like Unsplash and things like that? So you've got Unsplash, which is supposed to have all this free, you know, repository of images that the creators put up on the internet, and they say you're free to use. You can, you know, cite the person who took the photo, you know, provide on Unsplash by such and such an artist. Do you see copyrighted stuff showing up on those sites as well?
As long as the artists have relinquished control of the images and it's a public license, and they can attach, you know, conditions to that, such as I want credit, you need to, you know, give me credit whenever you use it. As long as you're adhering to those limitations, I would recommend screenshotting, you know, just make sure that you have a record. Most people probably aren't going to do that, and that's the lawyer in me talking, but at least read it, you know, at least make sure that you can say that you have personal knowledge. It's not that concerning. There's a ton of artists that want to gain recognition and have their work proliferated, and they're not worried about the monetary aspect of it. And so they do use websites like that. And that's completely legitimate. That's their prerogative to do that. You just need to make sure on your part that, you know, if it says don't use it commercially, you're not using it commercially. If it says give me attribution, that you actually are giving them attribution in the proper way, which can sometimes be specific. It doesn't always just mean their name and where you got it from. Sometimes they want to link back to a website, or they want the title of the work. So just, you know, just make sure that you're reading what you're signing. Basically, when it comes to getting copyrighted images off the web, there are a whole bunch of different tiers that people choose, and it's their prerogative to do so with their intellectual property. So it's really incumbent on you to make sure that you have paid for what you're using.
Right. And it's go ahead, Greg, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to comment that brings a whole other aspect to putting out blog posts and stuff like that that I never even considered. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's something I've never thought in the slightest bit about.
And you should be careful, because a lot of people don't, and people know that. And so, you know, you want to think that people are out there acting out of good faith and fair dealing. But the truth is that we do see sometimes that a small company or individual who has either a trademark registration or a desirable domain name or something like that, they'll sit on those rights until you get big enough where they know that you have deep pockets and you can buy them out because they have priority. So don't think that just because you haven't experienced a problem yet, or you've coexisted with someone that you know is out there, but you've coexisted peacefully for a set amount of time, don't think that you're out of the woods, because this is something that I see play out. And I'm biased because, you know, people come to me when they have problems, right, in this space. And so there's many more people out there that for which these problems never arise. But I see it frequently that you see these individuals or small entities that will tell you, well, I didn't have the money to enforce it then, but I didn't know that you were out there then. In reality, though, it just wasn't valuable because you didn't have deep enough pockets to enforce 10 years ago, whereas they can come after you now and now you can pay for it. And oh, by the way, it's 10 years later, so you're not going to want to change your brand name after all this time. So you're going to be more willing to pay them out than to go through all of that headache. So it really is important to just get it buttoned up out the gate so that those kinds of issues don't arise later on, because it is something that snowballs. Every year that you're in business, you have more brand recognition. There's more goodwill attached to your name. So if you have to change it, even if you have to tweak it or change your logo or something like that, you are erasing investment that you put into that brand. And that could be mitigated through some forward thinking where you don't limit yourself into thinking, this is my small arena of services or this is my small geographic location, but instead thinking nationally and globally when it comes to brand names.
Greg, do you have anything in your kind of going on in your business right now, maybe that you'd want to share, or thoughts that I know this conversation was of particular interest to you. So is there anything kind of tangible, real life example that you have questions on right now?
Well, I have one. Yeah, actually, there's someone I know locally here who's in the same field we're in, who they created their business in another state, and from where they live in, and then after they already had their business and their brand going a little while, found a similar business in the same field that is geographically close to them, that basically probably just organized in a different state that has almost the exact same name. It's just a spelling difference, basically. And it probably predated my friend's business. So, I'm kind of wondering, okay, if my friend went to the steps now to file for copyright and patent rights for his business name, would that then be, how does that affect with the business, the other person's business if it pre-existed?
So I want to clarify that the filing would be for the trademark, not the copyright or patent. But the if you were to file, so hypothetically, let's just to make it more concrete, let's say that your friend is in Florida and he's been operating since 2010, but there's somebody in California that's been operating since 2005 under a similar name. And now is there some threatened expansion, or your friend is just like aware of this now? Right. So because trademark rights accrue through use, your friend is not without recourse here. He has a good argument that customers in the geographic location in which he's been operating associate that brand exclusively with him. And so anybody coming into that location with a similar name would cause confusion because he's the prior user in that geographic region. Depending on the facts, I think it might be valuable to file a federal application. And of course, this is a vacuum. I don't know if there are other users in other states or even in the same state with similar names that would absolutely affect the analysis. But assuming for the sake of the hypothetical that these are the only two users and they are in different states and one predates the other, I would say that the best thing that the later filed or the later user could do would be to be the first filer of the application. It's a very niche area of trademark law, but there is something called a concurrent use proceeding wherein the trademark office will allow you to split up the country. If you were a first to file, but there's a prior user out there, that prior user can file something called a concurrent use proceeding where they assert their rights in their geographic region and kind of carve up the federal constructive rights that way. Never a bad idea to file an application if you aren't afraid of the risks associated with doing so. However, I will say the issue with these types of situations is that if two people are using the mark, my bet is that other people are as well. And I would recommend doing a comprehensive search to assess the level of coexistence, because that's going to affect the argument. I also want to point out that if a major source of confusion that I see from people who are just learning about trademark rights and intellectual property is that they'll do a business search. They'll go on the Secretary of State website for their state, and they'll do a search of whatever business name they want, whatever brand name they want. They'll plug into the business search. And that's how they are screening to see if somebody else is functioning under a similar name. That is not sufficient. That has very little to do with trademark law. Whatever you are registered with the state is between you and the state. You can operate under a different brand name or multiple different brand names, and they don't care about that. I mean, you might have to file a doing business as, you know, depending on your extent of your use in the state laws. But let's say that your friend has the same LLC name as somebody in California, but they are doing business, consumer facing business, under completely different brand names. There is no trademark conflict there because the public is not going to be confused. You know, but on the flip side of that, it is not sufficient to go onto a Secretary of State website and do a search and think that you're okay, because that doesn't matter. What you really need to be doing, I mean, it's not a bad idea just to get a feel for who was interested in similar verbiage for anything. But your best bet is, if you're doing it as an individual instead of an attorney or utilizing a third party, Google it. Because what we're really interested in is that consumer facing use. So if you get a demand letter and you're using the same a brand name that matches your LLC name, and you are interested in changing your trademark rather than fight the demand letter, you can do that just by changing your public facing brand. You don't need to change your LLC name. You know, you might want to file a DBA so that you make the complaining entity go away and feel more comfortable. But it shouldn't involve a whole lot of backroom logistical machinations to fix the problem. You can absolutely just change your public facing brand.
That's really interesting. You made one comment here. You said that there's some risks associated with filing, or at least you intimated that there's risk associated with filing. What does that mean?
So if you've been operating in a little corner of the internet or a little corner of the country, not drawing a ton of attention to yourself, and then you file a federal trademark application, all of a sudden you are going to start showing up on national watch services for anybody that has a similar trademark and pays for a watch service. They're going to get a report saying you filed a mark that is somewhat similar to this registered mark owned by this company. Are you interested in enforcing? And that's part of what I do every day, is look at these watch notices for my clients' marks and think for each one, is this close enough to my client's mark that this is a problem? So as soon as you file an application, you're going to start showing up on those watch notices. So it's kind of, you're waving a big red flag in front of a bull, if there is a bull out there. So that's kind of the homework that you need to do in advance of filing, is trying to determine, that's what we do through our search opinions, is trying to determine what bulls are out there. Like, when you go file and you're waving that red flag, like, who's it going to attract? And how similar are those registered marks, such that if there is a conflict, would we be able to, either because the trademark office says that, no, you can't have this registration because it's too similar to a registered mark, or because that other entity raises a hand and says, I don't think that they should get this registration because it's too similar to our mark, that we would have strong enough arguments to overcome either that refusal or that objection. But either way, yes, you need to be comfortable with putting yourself out there, making other competitors and third parties aware of your existence.
That's interesting. So let's summarize this, maybe to see what we've missed. You said, first off, obviously we check our name. Like, go out and check our name, and you gave great steps for that. We talked about copyright and stuff that we are putting on our websites. We talked about images that we use. What other things, is there anything else that we should really be paying attention to as we build out our brands?
The domain space is important to, especially if you have something somewhat a descriptive or generic mark. Always check to see what domains are available and what domains have been taken in addition to that Google searching. Because if the .com is available, but the .org is associated with a super shady business, you know, or a risque business, you might not be as interested in the .com. Or if none of them are available because they've been snapped up by domain squatters, then that's something you're going to want to be aware of. Even if there's no Google results, if the domain isn't available, then it's not a brand name that you're probably going to be interested in adopting. So it's just, it's really Google, it's the domains. If there is a domain name that is close to the mark that you're interested in, but there's no content on it, it is probably advisable to reach out to the owner prior to publicly adopting the brand, because the price will go up if they know that you're interested in it for a commercial reason. So stuff like that. It's just trying to button up as much as you can before you do any kind of public facing launch. But if you already have done a public facing launch, then it really becomes about doing as much as you can to button up your portfolio before you expand any further, or considering, you know, doing an assessment of what else is out there and considering, do I need to pivot now before I get any bigger?
Right. That's great. Madeline, let's jump into the final four here if we can. What is one piece of advice as it pertains to trademarks and intellectual property that you would give to an aspiring investor?
I think it's important to consult with attorneys. A lot of attorneys will do, you know, kind of for free consultations where they'll walk you through what is it. You don't know what you don't know, but we do. So if you, I talk to people all the time that don't end up being clients, or they end up being clients in some, because they need one application file. It's no, reach out to an attorney. I'm sure that they would be happy to schedule a consultation to talk about your needs. You're sitting on a pile of intellectual property if you're a business owner, and you're probably not going to know what to do with it, but we can help you with sorting that out and at least telling you what pitfalls to be aware of as you navigate your way forwards.
Right. That's great. The second question is, what is one thing you are currently doing to stay on top of your game?
To stay on top of my game, I recently took up running, and I really enjoy it because it gives me an hour 4 or 5 times a week where I get to sort of choose what to marinate on or listen to without kids screaming at me or work emails pinging at me. This is something that I'm going to build out as part of my life to just make sure that I have an hour 4 or 5 times a week to just sit and marinate, because I feel like my inbox has gotten a lot cleaner. My personal hobbies have expanded a lot, and my meditate every day. I think take an hour. Why not an hour? Do it for an hour and just go running and see what happens.
That's awesome. When it comes to giving back, what's one thing you're doing to make the world a better place?
My husband and I are both involved with the Second Wind Fund. I'm on the board, and he is a member of a finance committee for them. The Second Wind Fund is a nonprofit organization that helps connect Colorado youth with therapy services for youth at risk for suicide who have either logistical or financial barriers to therapy. So it's crazy, but suicide is the leading cause of death for youth in Colorado. So it's something that has touched our family personally. So we feel very strongly about it. And we're very happy to be involved with such an amazing organization. I encourage, you know, anybody listening who has family in Colorado or lives in Colorado or, you know, is involved in Colorado, take a look at the Second Wind Fund. It's an amazing organization. Really can't speak highly enough about it.
Wow. Good for you guys. That's admirable. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
My email is mllapidus@hollandhart, HollandHart.com. And that is the best way to reach me.
Wonderful. Madeline, thank you so much for your time today. And Greg as well. Thank you. Appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.